So I'll make a start. So as Kevin said, I'm at the University of Manchester, but I'm shortly moving to UCL in London. So this is the last thing actually I'm doing for the University of Manchester, which is a nice thing to finish on. So it's a response, of course, my presentation to the workshop theme, but it's also based on a much larger and emerging project that I'm working on urban contestations over space within cities, and I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. But I'm quite interested in the sociological and historical insights into how we understand the field of planning. So I trained as an urban planner, and I work within a planning department, so I'm not a geographer, but also the relationships to the particular issues around planning, which are very focused on normative practice. So in this presentation, I want to talk about one area of my work and hopefully make some connections to the workshop themes. And it's looking at how we understand a particular types of ethnicised space within cities, and particularly when they're the subject of development narratives. So either areas that are under threat of change, or indeed where there is more kind of collaborative forms of change that might involve the state and community organisations, as well as others, including property developers. So in this presentation, I want to focus on the post-colonial challenge and what these kinds of insights might reveal about aspirations of communities in cities and others in the remaking of city spaces. And the particular example I'm going to talk about is London's Chinatown, which is in the West End of London. So the post-colonial challenge provides a useful lens in which to re-examine narratives of ethnically differentiated space, and kind of in terms of cities, particularly in Europe and North America as well. There's often a sort of spatialization of ethnicity and an association with particular spaces with ethnic groups in many different ways, from ethnic enclaves, which is what I'm talking about, but also more pejorative connotations with ghettos and so on. So new historical narratives, as I've said, are very important in rethinking planning and adding to those accounts. And I'll talk a little bit more, but these are two quite important books that have been written. So Ordinary Cities by Jenny Robinson at UCL, and Provincialising Europe by Chakrabarty. So in terms of what is the post-colonial, but of course there's no one definition of what that is. I mean, some people talk about it more, I think, including James Sidaway there used to be a lot more talk of it as just being after colonialisation, and that kind of meaning is not so popular now. Others talk about it being emergent at the same time, and a particular critique as well of colonial relations. And indeed, London is a good example of a post-colonial city, a city based, the heart of a former empire, but also where even now there's continuing migration from places that are former colonies as well as not just former British colonies, but elsewhere. So in terms of planning, it's a component, of course, of an attempt to rationalise.
Did you want one? Someone requested a mic.
Okay, I can use it, yeah. So is it better with a mic or not? It doesn't seem to make any difference. So, okay. which gained momentum during the end of the 19th century. But aspects of planning, of course, have become associated with a critique of modernism in the 20th century. Of course, it's not so simple as that. I don't want to be an apologist for planning, but of course, there's much more complexity. But indeed, as Jenny Robinson has written about, there is a bias in urban theory, which has generalised greatly, but is based mostly on Western cities, or a lot of the early urban theory. And Jenny's work has been very important in revealing that bias. But it's important to note the post-colonial challenge is not just about accounts of different cities and just opening them up to other areas. And Ananya Roy talks about that just through having other accounts, that it can just still have the same kind of frameworks and bias within them. But she talks more about it being an unmaking and remaking of categories. So it's about rethinking, certainly within planning, the public interest, which is a particularly difficult issue which planners keep on talking about. But certainly much justification for planning action is based around a rather liberal notion of public interest for normative action. But the question that continues to be asked is for whose interests, whose public interest, and for what purposes do we use it? So drawing upon these kinds of theories and rethinking the models of urban theory that we have, as Robinson talks about, when she says about encouraging acknowledgement of the parochial nature of much of which still passes for universal theory in the Western Academy. So the irrelevance of some cities to kind of theories or urban theory echoes the way in which some people living within cities now are seen as irrelevant or less desirable in terms of the economic strategies and the marketing strategies for the future that are used by cities' elites. So whilst there's, saddens me to say, much critical engagement with planning outside of planning, particularly in geography. I think there's been a great deal of very interesting work in history. And M. Christine Boyer, who's written several very critical accounts of the development of planning, and talks about the contemporary arts of city building are derived from the perspective of white middle-class architectural and planning professionals who worry about, in a depoliticised fashion, about a city's competitive location in the global restructuring of capital. But within the planning canon and within planning theory as a whole, there's still, those accounts still are kind of more outside it. And there's kind of, if you read Peter Hall's work, who's actually in the department I'm joining, you do see it is a kind of account of the city fathers and like the great work they did. And actually, kind of, when he does sort of mention women, it's quite disparaging about the nature of their work. So there's a need to challenge these kinds of things. So the explanations for planning's underachievement, and this would be, so Robert Taylor Holmes, so Chicago, one of the cities I'm looking at, they're often talked about in terms of failure because of issues around race and community. But of course, the city is, the story is much more complex, and without going into too much detail, Robert Taylor Holmes, Cabrini Green, and so on, it's much more about the governance, the political kind of issues around the fact that in Chicago, public housing, there was a lot of racist opposition to public housing going into white areas, and where homes tended to be built were in areas that were kind of economically disadvantaged anyway, and you know, a long history of mismanagement where in the end Chicago's homes had to be taken over by the federal government. So there are various explanations for planning's underachievement in what it aspires to do. So the idea, firstly, that the rationalities of planning or past rationalities have under-theorised the public interest, and of course it's a much more fragmented concept, that we have a lack of knowledge of difference, and you know, cities and areas have become more diverse, so we need to engage with this changing the changing patterns we see, and also importantly the lack of participation of communities. And that's been a sort of critique, particularly within planning, since the 1960s, where, and since then, there has been much more of a commitment to public engagement, although still there are significant problems. So what are the remedies seen to be? Well, I've just talked about the public interest, of revitalisation of public interest. There's a lot of work going on around that, and also the inclusion of others. So not just that, Leonie Sandercock is quite prominent in looking at difference within cities, talks about voices from the borderlands in talking about multicultural cities, but also the inclusion of other actors as well, and the realisation that with the kind of fragmentation of the state, that it can't just be state-led anymore. So far, so good. Is that not just the answer to the problem and quite easy to deal with? Well, one of the key critiques that has been more developed recently is that the engagement with others, so the post-colonial challenges I've said, often fails to challenge how the structures and norms in which planning and development operate in many ways. And there's various people that have kind of worked on that. So Brenda Yeo, based here, work looking at Singapore has been really important in understanding how norms are structured, and I think she talked a lot about kind of issues of regulation of public space. And Mariana Valdeverde, who's in Toronto and a social and legal specialist, looks at places like Toronto which have bylaws which prohibit the vending of any food in the street other than hot dogs, because any other kind of food apparently isn't Canadian. So make that what you will. And also Janice Barry and Libby Porter's work on the contact zone. So they're actually looking at Indigenous groups in Australia and in Canada, talk about the ways in which texts and institutions restructure and reinterpret ways in which people view the world into kind of planning frameworks, and then questions why they're not engaged within that. So in terms, and this is actually from very near where we're all based. I don't know why it's where. Oh, sorry. So Salford, and that's like an emblematic example of kind of post-war development in the UK, which obviously is developed to make better places, because there was a lot of slums in that area before, but is kind of this kind of faceless, anonymous kind of space which hasn't worked very well in the UK. So in terms of methodological innovations, which was something that was mentioned in the workshop, the idea of transnational and comparative research is of course compelling for many reasons. So there's an imperative in the post-colonial in engaging with the complexities and the linkages within and between cities and people, and addressing some of the issues of differing temporalities which are evident in the post-colonial city, so challenging the linearity in discussions of progress. And Dipesh Chakrabarty in his Provincialising Europe talks a lot about that, about Europe not being a place but a kind of concept. And Robinson as well, is all part of rendering cities as ordinary cities. And the work of Kevin and others has of course drawn our attention to the policy transfer and travel as well. And I think as well as that, it's an opportunity to look back at the cities that we're most familiar with and the research we're more familiar with afresh, to sort of look at different things that we take for granted and how we can challenge our own kind of assumptions as well. So I just wanted to say something briefly just about the linkages to race theory as well. So as I said, Dipesh Chakrabarty's book's very important in the process of situating the European project and challenging these notions of progress. So and the way in which it embodies the kind of imperatives of the elites, and the way in which difference becomes categorised through elites and experts, and how that can reflect colonial past within the present. So the importance of, as I've said before, about rewriting back in other histories and trajectories, and seeing how a politics of the postmodern and post-colonial might reinvigorate and revitalise our understanding of difference. So Baba's work, so originally based in the UK, around culture has been particularly important in how he talks about how the mosaic of cultures and the way that they essentialise difference. And the picture on the right is a very prominent black artist in the UK, Sonia Boyce, who I think has just recently been made Professor of Fine Art. So her work in the 80s, and it's interesting because at the time that she was thinking about becoming an artist, she decided not to, because there really wasn't a place for black artists, particularly working on sort of more political works and representations of blackness. And she was going to go back and work in a department store, but she decided against it because she went to some radical conference. So the ways in which black representations in the UK have been problematic, and Paul Gilroy as well talks about the sort of the fact that actually there's some deep hierarchies evident within them. So it's rethinking about how urban politics manifests itself within post-colonial cities, and Brenda Yeo talks about post-colonial cities need to be analysed within a single post-colonial framework of intertwining histories and relations, and also Nina's work, which talks about other ways of understanding the pathways and trajectories beyond the traditional ethnic lens. And planning is quite neglectful of these structures, histories and memories, and this is a sign from London. It's kind of blurred, but it's a sign that would be familiar in the 50s and 60s. It says no Irish, no blacks, no dogs. And I know when my father moved to London, this is a sign that he remembers seeing. He found it very difficult to find accommodation in London at the time, but this was seen to be kind of permissible to do, and it took kind of a lot of political action to ensure a lack of racial or anti-racism legislation. So Paul Gilroy gave a lecture at the Institute of Visual Arts a couple of years ago, and he was talking about London. He said we need to comprehend the colonial character of this city in a more profound way than has happened before. And the important intellectual work that has gone on, so this is a book about race and racism in 70s Britain from the Centre of Contemporary Cultural Studies in Birmingham, was very important in rethinking the relations of ethnic minorities within the UK context. So just as a side note, this was one of the most important departments we had, and really the emergence of cultural studies in the UK and beyond, and it was abolished in the research assessment framework, which, going back to this idea of bureaucracies. So it's the move, the black political movement, which does incorporate in many ways other minorities, although it's kind of more complex, but I won't get into it, since then has gone on to really be led by a number of people, particularly Doreen Lawrence, whose son was murdered in a racist attack. And actually the reason that she came to prominence is because of the fact that she brought the Metropolitan Police under the spotlight for the handling of not only the murder inquiry, but the inquiry into how the murder had been dealt with, and revealing the Metropolitan Police Service to be an institutionally racist organisation, and she continues to do excellent work. So these kinds of things aren't taken into account. And Roy talks about the public interest and talks about really that we need an ethics of post-coloniality. So to move from this idea of liberal responsibility for others to post-colonial accountability towards them. And I think this is very important, particularly in cities like London, to engage with that. And to understand, Catherine Rankin talks about colonialism as a constitutive present history of planning. And how that might mean that groups have different access to space within a city or different capabilities. So there might be different kinds of governance arrangements which are seen to be very useful in city development, which are put in place to empower some, but they might actually add extra pressures or cause others to remove themselves from engagement in governance. And how am I doing for time? 5 minutes. I won't talk about that slide. So in terms with ethnic space, as I've said, I'm interested in Chinatowns, but other ethnic spaces as well. So this is London's Chinatown. Sorry, those pictures aren't the greatest. And I'm concerned with how ethnic spaces which historically emerge become sanitised in some ways, and the ways in they become reconstituted, which might signify breakages with past understandings of their formation. So the kind of forgetting of the histories that form them. And the histories are, of course, about intense segregation, which vilified Chinese people, not just in England, but across Europe and North America, and where physical violence and the destruction of property play a key part. So the first Chinatown in London, in Limehouse, was subject to kind of physical attack on a number of occasions. And actually, Chinatown moved to the West End of London in the 60s. So it's about early claims for something that's quite popular, the right to the city. But this, I would argue, these are kinds of parts of those early claims in a context of regulated immigration, intense prejudice, and power relations. And the relationship to China and to the differing political regimes, which actually facilitated or inhibited migration at particular times. And in places like Chicago and Vancouver, also a history since the 60s of community organising for ethnic Chinese. So the focus has been on, or my focus has been on, the diverse Chinese population, so sort of the fact that the Chinese are talked about as one group, when in fact, of course, we are not. And looking at the kind of commercial set role that it's played and how that kind of leads into a narrative of city development in London. So this area since the 1980s has been under the leadership of the City Council Westminster, but also it's mostly owned by two property companies, one of whom's a pension investment company, Shaftesbury. And that's been very good in kind of unifying streetscape and kind of the narratives of placemaking. You can't really see, I think, behind there, but behind the lion, which was brought in, the betting shop there, and that's been very controversial with the Chinese community because they've always been Chinese-owned businesses renting there, and the sort of movement in of betting shops and also I think a couple of bars has been seen to kind of dilute Chinatown. But it's also about the property portfolio of the people that own the property. But in terms of like. So what I'm interested in is about sort of Chinese-ness, but the way it's represented is about what does being Chinese look like? And apparently it's like this gate, which was actually designed by a British architect in Westminster City Council, and there's been long-standing controversy about it, and it's still there. They can't decide what to do with it, and these kinds of lions and other images. And it's a recourse to traditional forms of what Chineseness is meant to be, and ancient motifs as signifiers of that. And basically, there's just a list of things that you can have in there. So I think, without wanting to get into it any further, it's about Chineseness as a pastiche. I did want to just show you this quote. So Prince Charles has become very interested in Chinatown. And what's quite interesting is at the end of the quote that he wants to talk about Chinatown becoming more authentically Chinese, which is kind of interesting in many ways. And so just sort of a couple of concluding words about what does it mean in terms of city development? That's obviously controversial and disputed within the community, and the way it's been used has been about kind of in terms of city elites. But other kind of representations of Chinese politics and so on are kind of silenced in many ways. So we need to think about cities and post-colonial accountability. And when spaces are branded and marked, who has the right to name those spaces or speak about them, and what mechanisms are appropriate? So it's about moving between beyond fixed, traditional and untroubling representations of difference and engaging in more fruitful ways with the post-colonial challenge. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Next speaker is Dan Motto.